This is the Business Storytelling Show with Christoph Trapp. Name a top 20 storytelling podcast and a top 5% podcast globally, Christoph chats with thought leaders and experts to share tips and tricks that can help you tell your company's stories better to drive business results. Available wherever you listen to podcasts, live streamed on major social media channels, and part of the DB&A television network, available on most U.S. television sets and streaming on Roku and Amazon Fire. Here's Christoph with today's episode. Let's go.
That's right. Let's go, business storytellers. Hey, how's everyone doing? Today, we want to talk about data journalism. So as you might know, I grew up as a journalist. I would still consider a lot of the stuff I do today is very closely aligned to what I've learned as a journalist. Do it for companies and with a different goal in mind, quite frankly. And sometimes I still work with journalists. People call that earned media. Not a big fan of that terminology, quite frankly, but that's what people call it. So today we want to talk about data journalism and what is that? Why do why is that a good strategy and how does it work? I asked Amanda Milligan to come back on the show. I don't know if this is her second time or third time, at least second time. So she's joining people like Joe Polizzi and others like that who have come back and still talk to me. So I appreciate that. So let's get her on the show here. Amanda just started at Stacker, a company that works in data journalism. I'll let her tell the story, what they do exactly. Amanda, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back. I will come on anytime you'll have me, Christoph. I appreciate it.
You're still talking to me.
I started working at Stacker 3 weeks ago, so it's pretty new. Not the company. The company's been around since 2017. They're essentially a newswire. They have been writing data-driven stories, like I said, since 2017, and they have a built-in syndication network of trusted publisher connections that they have, including MSN, SFGate, Newsweek, the Tribune Media Company. I mean, really high quality, high authority publications that trust the stuff that they're syndicating out. So what we say often is, if you've heard of the AP, the Associated Press, or Reuters, they're like that. They create content and syndicate it out to any publication that really wants it. It's free. It's kind of awesome. And recently, they started working with brands. So that's where a lot of what I'm doing comes into play. And we can talk about that later. But
so very interesting. It's really two sides of the coin, right? So first, you create data journalism. And we talk about mm-hmm. how do you use data to create stories on here all the time, right? Whether it's machine-generated content. We talked about that before with narrative science and also data that's created by us, like Michelle Lin, when she was on the show, we talked about how do you create that research. So that's an interesting point. So they actually started on the journalistic side, right? So like true journalism, not a brand trying to pitch to. So talk about that. How did that start? And then why is it moving into on the brand side? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I loved about them. When they reached out to me, I was wondering, what does that mean when you're reaching out to brands? And they were saying that they are first and foremost a publication, and they are all about their publishers. That is the number one priority to them. And I think that this is something that's often lost on marketing. People try too hard to build links or get what they want, the anchor text they want, whatever it is, that they lose sight of genuinely creating good content and having real partnerships with people and providing value. So the fact that that was where their heads were at, that they knew that that was the most important thing, was really important to me. The brand side, obviously, it's a way to monetize this awesome platform that they have, where they can give all these free stories to journalists. But they realize that brands, most companies, I mean, you hear about all these companies like buying out media properties or launching their own publications, but they're huge companies that they can afford this. Most companies can't afford to do that. They just can't. And I think a lot of people listening to this can relate to that. There's probably a ton of stuff they want to do, but can't afford to do, don't have the resources to do. So we figured that we can partner with a lot of them. However, there are caveats to that. It's not an advertising play. You don't get to just choose whatever is written about. It's journalism. We take data that exists. We're not spinning the story. You have to really buy into that philosophy in order to participate and partner. So that was really important to me. Christoph, I feel like I'm excited to chat with you about it because I feel like people who have a degree in journalism, I never actually did journalism, but I still, it's the virtues of that profession are really important to me. So I'm always looking for that in the marketing realm and people who value that.
Awesome. So how does that work with a brand? So of course, nothing in the world comes free, right? There's always some reason why anybody does anything. I mean, even when we can't figure it out. But why, how does it work? So I get it. You have a company, you create data-driven stories, news media companies use them. That makes sense, right? That's like really just a freelancer. I know you're not a freelancer, but it's like a freelancer pitching a story and you run the story, right? But when you add the brand, I mean, when I create content for Vox Pop Me, which is totally, they're totally useful stories. They're very journalistically leaning, but they have something to do with the business, right? We're trying to gain attention, right? We're trying to get market share by people finding us. When you make that match with the brand, how does that work? How do brands participate?
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest learning curve is that it's not going to be directly about your product or service offering. That's not usually going to work in the journalism side. No reporter or any reader of a publication is going to be like, yeah, tell me more about the specific thing that you're trying to sell. So it's more about the greater industry. And I typically think that what brands should do is think about what their brand principles are, what aside from just the very specific value they're offering, what in general are they trying to offer? Like, for example, maybe there's an office product that's like, we want to make this specific thing easier. But in general, they're just trying to make your at-home work environment better, right? So you're zooming out a little bit. You're getting a sense of like, who are you trying to help? And in a general sense, what is the mission of what you're trying to do? In that zooming out, you can find so many other story ideas that exist. It requires that tangential viewpoint. And then what you're signaling to publishers and readers is you're not just interested in sales. You're interested in actually providing that kind of value to people. And you're putting the work behind it because it's not easy. You can't just throw a piece of content, like good piece of content together, as anyone who has tried knows. So when you put that time investment in, or the money investment in, and you're like, no, we're going to take this seriously. We do want to create stuff that is meaningful. Then that's what you start signaling. It's not just like, we're here to get your money. We're here to like only do this one very specific thing. We're here because we actually believe in good content. We believe in helping you out in other ways that are relevant to our overall mission. And we're going to do it right. So you're getting your brand name out there. It is more top of the funnel, and that's how you should set up your KPIs. You shouldn't be expecting conversions immediately after this, but you should be expecting that more people are now aware of your brand and they're aware of your values.
I mean, you don't have to convince me on this model at all. And I know when I was a journalist, I mean, plenty of people reached out to me all the time with good, you know, hey, are you doing a story on this thing that just happened? We have an expert that can give you some insights or whatever, right? I mean, this is just the new version of people calling me back in the day, right? I'm showing my age here, but you know, it's really the same thing. But why do you think there's so many companies, maybe I shouldn't say it like that. Do you agree or disagree that there is still a lot of companies that always, they don't want to do it because it takes a little longer, right? It's much quicker to just spend a gazillion dollars on running ads and I can measure it directly. And this works. I know it works for a fact, but it takes a little bit, right? And it's not always measurable as much. I mean, so for example, Amanda, you're my go-to expert for PR, right? One of a group of people that I know. But how did that happen? Give me one touch point, right? You don't have it because I heard you on the podcast. I heard you here. I saw you there. You did whiteboard Wednesdays or Friday, whatever day it is, you know, it's like you're everywhere and you just see it. And every once in a while it bubbles up and you have a question on PR. That's kind of where you go. So why are brands, why are some people fighting it so much, or are they?
Oh, it's definitely one of the hardest problems, right? I think people deal with this all the time. It's much more difficult to quantify, because you're absolutely right. I mean, we used to get leads at Fractal that would be like, I'd ask them, like, where did you hear about us? So like, all kinds of places. Like, we don't even remember the first. So when you talk about attribution models, it's a little arbitrary if you only do first touch or last touch. You're still missing out on all this in between. So it's a challenge. It's hard. And there really isn't a 100% way to hone in on the full value of work that isn't bottom of the funnel. And we're all human beings, right? Isn't the psychology that we all want instant gratification more than we're willing to wait? So paid ads give that to you. They give you the money now. The problem, I mean, not even a problem. There's definitely a place for paid. It's that if you don't supplement it with any kind of organic work or anything where you're putting in more time or putting your budget towards organic, then you're just constantly repeating the same process with paid. You're doing it over and over again. Usually they pair best together, but it's tough. It's about setting the expectations. And I don't know if you have anything you want to add to this too, but it's a lot of the time saying like, okay, we're going to start this. It's about building your brand's authority. And that's like kind of the case you're making, is why the way your brand is perceived important. When it used to not be as important. It's definitely more important now.
Well, and if you only do paid campaigns too, right? They stop as soon as you stop spending money. And the other thing with paid campaigns too, just by the way, is, you know, you can be outbid, right? And I mean, I was on a page the other day and I was focusing on SEO for that page and for the search engine result page. And I mean, the ads, it was like six ads. I mean, I'm like, okay, so I'm on the right track here, because this is a super competitive keyword, right? So if I can figure out how to get on that page organically, guess what? When you guys all stop spending money on your ads, my article is still going to be there.
Yeah. Or your snippet or your image or whoever you're making it up to the top of that SERP. Yeah, absolutely.
So something to keep in mind. So you mentioned time, the time you invest. And that's, quite frankly, time is always a little bit of a trigger word for me, because what was really hard for me to understand as a journalist, especially, the amount of time put into any content creation does not equal any outcome of any kind. So so we do this podcast, right? So us talking here, 27 minutes, it could blow up, right? It could be most listened to podcast, but it took us 27 minutes,
right?
You know, if I spend 8 hours editing every little and ah, you know, like, it's not going to help the performance. So how important is finding that balance when people work with you? Like, how much time does it take to create stuff for the media? Or, oh, one last example. The other day, I had the Washington Post email me and they said, can we use this snippet? And I said, yeah. They said, okay, thank you. Like, that was it. Like, it didn't take me any time. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, no time. Yeah. And it was awesome. So how do you kind of figure out how to consolidate that, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's a big question. I think for the folks at Stacker, what they do is they're listening to see, because they have this network of people that they're sending these stories to. They're not guessing what they want. They're studying what they want and they're asking for what they want. So yes, you can explicitly ask. People don't always know what they want, so that only goes so far. You know, what kind of stories are they looking for? If you have relationships with journalists, you can do the same. But also, like, for these networks that we pitch or send our stories to, distribute our stories to, you can see what else they're publishing. So if you're trying to share your content in a certain way to a certain audience, take a look at what's already out there and what's already working and what these publishers are already doing. Format wise, I think is one of those things that can be a huge time suck. So if you have a table or a graphic of some sort and you just spend a ton of time designing or developing it when you didn't have to, if you're overcomplicating it, I think that's where you can run into this problem that you've brought up, Christoph, where it's like, I just spent, you know, 8 weeks on this this developed graphic or this interactive. And actually what they want is the static image. Like, they didn't actually need it. Now, I'm not saying that's always the case, but that's where you have to kind of investigate. Does this publisher even publish interactives? Do they just want to know about their own area? Like, people tend to guess on that stuff, but it can take up so much of your time.
It's so interesting. Do they even publish interact? I mean, when I have people pitch me stuff and I'm like, that is not even what I talk about. Like, they want to come on the show, you know, and they want to do whatever. And I'm like, I don't even talk about that topic, you know? It's just like, yeah, it's so interesting. Now, the last time you were on, you talked about the three formats that media companies like the best. And I do think one of them was interactive something, right? Was it not? It was like interactive content, long form content, and something else. Am I making that up? Or, I mean, I'm only mentioning two out of three, something like that, right?
Yeah, I don't remember if interactive was. I think for when it comes to publications, the important thing is, can they actually handle it on the development side? Like, some of them literally can't host it. So I think it adds a level of authority to your content if you're able to create it. And the big piece of it, which can still be done statically, is to look at how somebody can see themselves in the content. That's really the important thing. So, you know, like Stacker realized that a lot of these news publications, they just wanted the local angle. They didn't need to know every place on the planet. They just wanted to know where they ranked. And they wanted to talk about that specifically. So you can either do that in a couple ways. You can localize it yourself. Say you are specifically targeting segments of the audience in different geolocations. Then sure, do that. Sometimes people build the interactive because we kind of want to do that across the board. And we don't know how else to include it other than to make it an interactive and let the person figure it out for themselves. So they can type in their zip code or they can look at their state or whatever it is. But the reason why that works is because people want to see themselves in the content. So you're trying to figure out for your specific publication what they prefer, because it's not a one size fits all deal. If it's on your site and you're not pitching it to media or anything like that, then maybe, you know, you cater only to your audience, or you use the interactive because you want to cater to a national audience and you promote it on social or whatever. But the important thing is to remember why you're doing that. You don't want to just like make something interactive because it's fun to click around and see different things. It's like, what can we do? What can we filter to allow people to see themselves in this data? So it's not distant from them anymore. They're like, oh, I understand. This is where I fall. And this is where everybody else like me falls. And that is where the story lies.
So, I mean, of course, you have to use the data to tell a story. Don't just dump data over here and hope somebody will find it interesting. So when we talk about data, when I was a journalist, I gathered data. Sometimes, you know, we called it computer-assisted reporting. Once again, I'm showing my age. Right? Like, super common today. But back then, like, that was like, we had classes on computer assisted reporting and all that crap. But anyway, you know, but I would gather data and then basically based on what I find, I would write an article, right? So for example, I actually did a study on traffic tickets in our metro area. And what I found it interesting, is that if you fought your ticket, your chances were 50-50 to win.
So I've heard that, and it's cool that you confirmed it. I always had this theory that there were things that you kind of suspected to be true or you heard to be true, but there was no data to back it up. I think those stories do so well because you actually proved something that people claim. And I also love that you said you found it interesting. That's where everybody should start. Like, if you're looking at a set of data and you don't find anything interesting about it, you're probably not going to, I mean, unless you're very disconnected from your target audience and they would find it interesting and you just don't care. Like, you work at you market at a company you don't really like feel any passion about. But if you find it interesting, other people probably will too. It's a good place to start.
It's interesting you say that. I do enjoy much more when I create content that I care about too, right? That I'm learning something and whatnot. But every once in a while, I do have articles that perform really well. And I'm just kind of like, meh, like, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad it's done. So, okay. So let's stay with the traffic ticket example. So here, that's the data. That's interesting enough already. but that's not really a story yet, right? Like, how do people get out of it? What do they do, et cetera? So I pulled some cases and I looked at them and people were doing all kinds of different things. My favorite story, still remember it years later, is the woman that got out of a ticket. I don't know if she got out of it or she just had a lower penalty. And she said, I couldn't have been speeding. I drive by this little church and I always say a little prayer. Had I been cheating, speeding, I wouldn't have been able to finish my prayer. And I did.
See, but that adds so much detail to this narrative. Yeah.
So, all right. So, but talk to me about where does the data come from? How do we get a story out of it? How do brands fit into that model?
Yeah. And I mean, you being a journalist know that there is a lot of public data available that people aren't sifting through on a regular basis, right? So that's a place to start. There's all kinds of free data that exists. There's free local government data. There's free national government data. There's internal data at your company. I think this is one of the most overlooked things. I talk about this all the time. And at Stacker, they love when people work with us and they have internal data they want to write a story on because it's yours. You're adding to your level of authority by saying that it's your company that is releasing this information. You're the primary source. So thinking about obviously what you're able to share legally, not, you know, just throwing any data out there that you've collected, but what is a story that you can tell based on what you have learned? Like if you're e-commerce, seeing trends in the way people are buying things, there are stories in a lot of this data. And Christoph, you bring up a good point though, that, you know, in some cases, if you're going the route of creating the data, you're doing all of this yourself, and then you're pitching it to journalists, sometimes they will want to tell the story around the data. But you still have to say what you think is interesting about it. You can't just give them, here's a data set, have fun. At Stacker, their process is, they take the data, they see the story in the data, they break that down, and then they add, just like you said, that narrative component of, and it's not biased or subjective, but it's, what does this mean? You have to explicitly say, this is why this is important. This is the context for this information, because not everyone's going to know. You might know why you pulled that data in the first place, but adding that color to a story is what is really going to drive it home for reporters who say, okay, like this is why this is important to my audience. It's not just some numbers. It's these numbers tell a story, and this is what that story is.
So what's interesting to me, I didn't actually mean to make myself full screen there, but what's interesting to me too about when you pull internal data, I think that's fantastic. But the internal data, in my opinion, I'm wearing my journalism hat right now, it can't just show that you are the best.
Like, oh, yeah, yes, 100%.
I mean, don't get me started on those kind of people that pull data and the end result is, you have to work with us. I think the Marketing Artificial Intelligence Institute, I don't know if they, I'm assuming they still do it, but when they first started their conference, their articles were written very journalistically. Like they really got me hyped up about the problem. And then like, here's the solutions. And like, oh, by the way, there's a conference. Like just by the way, right? But like this conference was not the only solution for me to learn about AI. There was all kinds of other things. The other thing, what's the danger though? So if you were to come to me and CEO Amanda says to reporter Christoph here, here's our data, we have some, this is a good story. And I say, well, I need to see the data, like prove it. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, what is it? So, I mean, how prepared do you have to be to be transparent? And I mean, you have to be believable, right? You can't just be like, here's a—
Oh yeah. Yeah. So this is where marketers try to take advantage of the situation. And, you know, to your point, that those stories where they're like, yeah, it's basically a case study. If you do that, if you're like, yeah, look how great we are. This is the data point. That's not news. That's a case study. So don't put that on your website, but don't be pitching that around. The data you have to have, and some people have asked me, like, can we reach out to journalists in advance? Like, I can't definitively say whether that's really effective. I think especially if you're a newer brand or you don't have that authority yet, you want to come to the table with the evidence like you're talking about. You don't want to say like, oh, we have a hypothesis and we're digging into the data. Like, no, here are the results of your findings for a study that does not have anything to do with your direct service offering. So like I said, if you're an e-commerce site and maybe you're finding that more and more people are buying a certain kind of product, and that, like, yeah, they could eventually buy it on your site, but it's a separate story. You're noticing trends that might be reflective of an entire shopping cultural shifts. You know, that's a bigger story, and that's what people are looking for. They're not looking for, tell me why, like, the top five best shoe stores and ours just happens to be number one or something. You know, you want to bring to the table, this is why we looked into this, why we find it interesting, and we think your audience is going to find it interesting, and this is what we found. You don't want to leave anything on the table where you're not being, you need to be as transparent as possible. So that's not just the data, it's your methodology too. That's the other piece. They're going to ask, if they don't up front, and you give them the data and they think it's interesting, they're going to follow up and say, how did you get this? Where is this from? How did you analyze it? So you have to feel very confident that what you did is sound and statistically significant, and just, it just makes sense, because journalists are going to want to do that level of vetting.
So what I always used to do in B2B journalism, which of course is a little bit of a different beast, but I go to conferences and somebody say, oh yeah, we're the number one in this field or whatever, which whatever, everybody says that, seriously. And so I would say, oh, awesome, congratulations. How do you know? Like, that was always, I was nice about it, right? But like, back it up. Tell me, how do you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? And I think that's something to keep in mind. My final advice, and we're always out of time so quickly, Amanda, thanks for sharing so many insights, is when you talk to the media, you have to speak in sound bites. Keep it short and simple so you can't say later on, hey, let's go, they only used this one soundbite and not the other one. So I think that's always, I hear that quite often. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time and expertise.
Thanks, Christoph, for having me. I always love our conversations.
That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Please rate and review our show on your favorite podcast channels. And don't forget to share this episode with your networks. We appreciate you. Until next time, let the best stories win.